Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Mark and Delia Owens. They are zoologists by their training, and they, for now more than 20 years, have been involved in doing research and conservation projects on endangered species in Africa. And their story is an interesting one, and we'll get them to tell more of the story in detail. But in short, they met when they were in graduate school in the 70s and realized that they had a dream in common to do what they could to save Africa's wilderness. So they went to Africa, they moved there, and spent 7 years living in the Kalahari Desert studying lions and hyenas. They wrote a book about that experience that was a bestseller, has been published all over the world, the book Cry of the Kalahari. Then in the 80s, they moved to a different part of Africa. They moved to Zambia, and the idea was that they were going to do some of the same kind of research. However, when they got there, they realized that there was a very significant problem in that part of Africa with poaching, particularly with people killing elephants. And so they decided that would be their new focus. And they have now published a book that is about that part of their lives. The book is Secrets of the Savannah. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. It's out now, and you could certainly find it in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. They are now living in the United States and are now, since the late 90s, have been concentrating on conservation issues in the northwestern U.S. and have been particularly concerned with grizzly bears. So maybe we'll talk a little bit about that. Any and all of this is certainly fair game for questions. I'm sure they'd be happy to take people's questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can certainly give us a call. Well, Mark Owens, Delia Owens, hello.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for having us on.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. It's quite an interesting story, and I must say that having read little bits about your experiences during the time that you were living in Africa, I'm sure that for some folks, that would indeed be a dream to be able to live in a wild place like that, to spend time observing, studying, being near these animals that probably for the rest of us, if we're lucky, we've seen them in a zoo, we've seen them in nature documentaries on television. But to see them up close is an experience that few people get.
Well, it was remarkable, David, especially our early experience in the Kalahari Desert of Botswana. We were the only two people in an area the size of Ireland, other than a few bands of bushmen. And at that time, the lions and the other animals had never seen human beings before. It's hard for people to imagine how special that is, because they were utterly unafraid of us. Okay, they were a little bit curious and cautious at first, but literally, from day one, they would walk right up to us. I remember one of my first walks in the bush there, a leopard walked right up to me and circled me, looking at me from about 3 feet away, just looking me up and down. He'd never seen me, an upright bipedal animal, before. And lions would come into our camp and sit right down by the campfire. It sounds Eden-esque, and it was.
Yeah. Well,
it was one of our greatest joys. The birds would land on our heads and on our shoulders as we walked through camp. Just living with animals that close was a privilege. It was an honor. Yeah.
They'd never been shot at or chased by trucks or in any other way alienated by humans, so they were sort of a tabula rosa waiting for an interaction with humans, and we tried to make it favorable for them.
So these big carnivores, they weren't sizing you up as potential prey, or were they?
No, they weren't really. They were curious. I remember we awakened one. We slept without a tent the first year. We didn't have enough money to buy one, and then a hunting company took pity on us and gave us an old ripped-out cabin-style tent, which we set up, and the flaps wouldn't zip close, so we tied them back. And one night, in the middle of the night, actually it was close to morning, we awakened with two full-size 500-plus-pound lions standing in the tent with us, smelling our sleeping bags, and they weren't curious about us in a predatory sense. They were just curious, and their whiskers were scratching the nylons of the tent, the nylon of the sleeping bag, which is what awakened me. And after a couple of minutes of that, they backed out and walked through our camp and sat down just outside the circle of camp, and we sat down behind them. It was really quite remarkable.
That doesn't mean that they never looked at us as prey. We had several encounters, of course, that were very scary. One time I was out making a place for Mark to land the little airplane that we had out in the middle of the desert. I would go walk along and look for holes so that when he came along in the airplane, he could land safely. And I was about 300 yards away from the truck out there all by myself in the middle of nowhere. All I had was a shovel that I was using to fill in holes, and I looked up, 9 lions were walking toward me, and they got down in a crouched position. It was very scary. It took everything I had to keep from running, because that's the worst thing I could have done, and I walked backwards toward the truck, and they would come closer and crouch, and I would sort of scream like an ape and throw the shovel around, and it, fortunately, I intimidated them enough that I was able to get about 20 yards from the truck, and then I ran like crazy and jumped in the truck. So we did have some scary moments, but most of the time it was just peaceful and very wonderful interactions with these animals.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested, if you wouldn't mind, in going back a little bit in your story and talking about when you met, when you were in grad school at Georgia, you realized that you had some common interests. At what point did this idea of essentially packing up and selling all your stuff and buying one-way ticket to Africa, how did you even talk about doing that?
Well, I remember it quite clearly, actually. It was a specific point in time. We just met, and we were seated in a lecture hall at the University of Georgia listening to a guest lecturer who had just returned from Africa. And he was talking about how the wildlife was all disappearing, especially the social carnivores, which was our interest, you know, wild dogs and lions and that sort of thing. And he was saying they were all being shot off in conflict with ranchers, and especially in southern Africa, and loss of habitat, et cetera. And you and I looked at each other in absolute horror, and we said, if we don't go now, there won't be anything left by the time we finish our degree programs and earn the money, et cetera, et cetera. So we took a temporary, if prolonged leave, somewhat prolonged leave from the university. Dilly had finished her bachelor's, and I'd finished my master's, and we couldn't get any backing, so we started working to field our own research project. I worked in a stone quarry eventually. We tried teaching, couldn't earn any money doing that. I eventually drove a truck in a stone quarry and ran the crushing plant, and Dilly worked in a department store, and 6 months after we did that, we sort of we heard a news report one morning that the Arabs had pulled the plug on cheap oil and that airfares were skyrocketing, and we said, we got to go today. So we jumped out of bed, threw everything in the house in the back of her station wagon, drove to the stone quarry where I'd been working, and auctioned everything away.
Including our wedding presents,
and with that money bought one-way tickets and left for Africa in search of a research study site.
Wow. That must have taken a lot of courage, not really knowing where you were going, and really burning the bridge, but really that's all in, both feet, 100%.
Well, we didn't look at it as taking courage at the time. We were young, and we looked at it as a great adventure, although we were very, very serious about studying these animals, and we found our way into Botswana and bought a third-hand Land Rover. And as Mark said, we couldn't even afford a tent, and we started searching around for a place. We wanted to find a place that was really wild, a place where people did not live. And so we made an old hunter told us how to get into a place he'd seen from the air in the Kalahari Desert. And so he told us to drive 99 miles down this old road to this broken palm tree, and then drive across the desert on a compass heading over the dunes, and that's what we did. And 3 or 4 days later, we found our way into this old river valley. It was a dry river, and there were like 2,000 springbucks and hemsbuck grazing on the short grass prairie, and we came over this dune, and as we drove among these animals, they just parted and let us drive through. They didn't even run from us. And we thought, well, this is just like the earth used to be. It was such a special moment. And so we set up a little camp and stayed for 7 years studying the lions and the brown hyenas.
And maybe I should introduce at this point again our guests, Delia and Mark Owens. If you're interested in reading about that part of their life and those experiences, they wrote a book about it titled Cry of the Kalahari, and it's the book's still in print. It's still available if you want to read it. They have also authored two others, The Eye of the Elephant and now Secrets of the Savannah, about some of their later experiences in Zambia, where they helped work with local people there to try to stop poaching of elephants and killing of elephants and rhinos, particularly for their ivory, but other animals were killed as well. And they suggested a different kind of model, economic model, for the people who were living there in the area that really helped to cut down on the poaching. And then I guess when there was essentially an international ban on the trade of ivory, that really did it. But no doubt, if you hadn't done what you had done, it would have been that would have made it very difficult for those people who had been trying to make a little bit of money off of the ivory from the elephants.
Well, what the ivory ban did, David, was it he devalued black market ivory in our area. In an 8-month period, it devalued it from about $200 a pound to $1.56 a pound.
Wow.
And so it made the program alternatives that we were offering, jobs and small business opportunities and improved agriculture and so forth, that much more valuable relative to the price of ivory, which had fallen. And so people at that point really began to get on board with these alternative programs. And basically what we did in the end was replace an entire illicit economy based on poaching with one based on the alternatives that I just mentioned. So it was there's no question the ivory ban catalyzed a lot of the success. It was remarkable.
Yeah. What you were talking about this period where you were living in, this was in Botswana, in the Kalahari, where you had the opportunity to study a lot of animals up close, and it was an area where you were the only humans, and as you explained, a lot of these animals, all of these animals had never seen people before. So here you had the opportunity to study animals, to watch them behave and live out their lives, no doubt learn some things that nobody had ever known before, because you had this opportunity to spend a lot of time just watching. Do you think that there were some particularly important things about, say, the behavior of lions or other animals that you were interested in, that you learned things that hadn't been observed before?
Yes, we were able to make some discoveries about several of the species, and that's always exciting to a young scientist. For example, brown hyenas had never really been studied, and I know people don't think of brown hyenas as being very exciting, but it was intriguing that they were one of the last large carnivores on Earth that had not been studied. And they were thought to be solitary animals that just walked around the desert eating on carrion and bones and things. And we discovered that, in fact, they had a secret society. It turns out they're very, very social. The females raise their young together in what amounts to a kindergarten. They all bring their cubs together in one large den, and they communally suckle each other's cubs, and they adopt orphans. And that's just not seen very often in nature at all. So it was very exciting. We were the first ones to discover this communal den. And so that meant a lot to us. And we also found that the lions in the Kalahari had a different social system than the ones in most of Africa, because the Kalahari was so dry. Their prides had to actually disband during the dry seasons, and they would spread out, and then when they came back together again in times of rain or when there was a large prey base, the prides would come back together, but not necessarily with the same individuals. They would come back and start hunting with lions that they didn't even know from before. So all these things were exciting to us, and also we learned a lot of things to try to save these animals, how much habitat and so forth that they needed, so that we could make recommendations to the Botswana government of how to conserve these animals.
Well, and it's also my understanding, though, that maybe some of your activities did not endear you to the government of Botswana, to the extent, at least one story I read was that after Cry of the Kalahari was published, you had been in the United States, and then you went back to Botswana with a crew from National Geographic, they were going to do a documentary, and when you got there, essentially the representatives of the government of Botswana threw you out of the country because they were really unhappy with what you had written.
Well, they were unhappy because what we reported, what during the course of our research in the Kalahari, we discovered and documented one of the largest antelope migrations on the continent, and that they were migrating from deep within the Kalahari Desert in times of drought toward the only available natural water sources that they'd used for thousands of years, which was the Okavango River Delta and the Bocheti River, Lake Gao, and a large arc of riparian habitat to the north in the northern part of the country. And what we discovered was that hundreds of miles of veterinary cordon fence, or fences that were supposedly built to prevent wildlife from the Kalahari mixing with cattle herds, they were called hoof and mouth control fences or foot and mouth control fences. The thought was that Kalahari wildlife harbored a reservoir of hoof and mouth disease virus that might spread into the domestic stock, but in fact no virus had ever been found in Kalahari wildlife. And anyway, these fences were blocking the migrations and killing off literally hundreds of thousands of antelope right before our eyes. And we tried and tried and tried again to get government representatives to take notice and to open corridors in the fences and so forth to allow these migrations to pass to prevent this high mortality. And no one ever even acknowledged the disaster that was unfolding right before our eyes, as I said. So we felt like we had no recourse but to publish this, our findings, in more popular media and try to draw world attention. And of course, Botswana took exception to that. And now the other part of the story is that these fences have never been actually demonstrated to control hoof and mouth disease, but they are nonetheless subsidized by the World Bank and the EU, which imports virtually all the beef Botswana produces at paying 2 to 3 times the world price and rebating 93% of the tariff for access to the market. So it's a huge economic incentive for Botswana to raise cattle under any circumstances and no matter what the environmental catastrophe. And that's what was going on and still is today.
But in fact, the Botswana government reversed their decision on us and said we could go back a year later. And we have gone back, and found our lions. They still had the radio collars on, and we've tracked them. And also what we've done is we've funded the construction of water holes in the northern part of the desert so that the wildlife can get to water that way. If they can't get through the fences, they can at least get to some water holes that we've had dug in the northern part of the reserve. So sometimes when you stand up for conservation issues, it's a sacrifice. It's a personal sacrifice because it was very difficult time for us, but we came up with the best solution that we could.
Yeah, well, it's glad to hear that the government maybe moderated their position a little bit. I think I read about this. It was a story that was published in the Washington Post back in the late 1980s.
Right.
In 1988. And it just talked about that particular event.
Well, the government hasn't really modified its position very much because they just built about 200 and some odd more miles of fence down the along the Bocheti River, blocking migrations from the Makarikari area. So It's still a very, very big festering issue, and it involves bushmen and their need to utilize these animals for protein, and it's still an ongoing debate.
Oh, so it just they moderated their position on you enough so that they said if you wanted to come back to Botswana, you could. They wouldn't
that's
block
right.
you at the border from
that's right.
From going in.
That's quite correct.
But then I guess that really, it was that little run-in with the government of Botswana, that was the reason that you then ended up having to, when you wanted to continue your research, to look someplace else to do it. And I guess it's my understanding, at least that's how it is you ended up then in Zambia.
That's correct, yes. We set off up north from Johannesburg, South Africa, looking for another wilderness in which we could conduct a comparative study of lions in a more mesic environment. Modern environment, which we found in the northern end of the Rift Valley in extreme northeastern Zambia, and this was the North Luangwa National Park, is the North Luangwa National Park, But in those days especially, it was really a park on paper only. It was about 2,800 square miles of literally raw, untouched wilderness that had been set aside during the colonial era when Zambia was known as Northern Rhodesia. But nothing had ever been done with it. It had just been sort of lines had been drawn across a map. And we found this place and went in there, and it was just absolutely pristine, or it seemed to be at first, and began setting up a camp and intending to do our research. And then, frankly, all hell broke loose when we discovered major poaching gangs were exploiting the area. More for everything, not just elephants. They were shooting elephants for ivory. And in fact, at that point, it had already killed somewhere between 80 and 100,000 elephants in that one valley in the previous 12 to 13 years. But they were still shooting 1,000 a year, and they'd already extinguished all the black rhinoceros. And we discovered this one morning when gunshots broke out around our camp, and we responded by trying to get game scouts, and found that they were a ragtag bunch who were had basically no food, no support, and they only had seven of them to protect a park the size, one and a half times the size of Delaware, and they only had four rifles, only one of which worked, a single round of ammunition, and of course they couldn't mount any kind of defense against poachers. So this park, so-called, was literally rather than being a pristine wilderness, it had become a shooting gallery for large gangs of commercial poachers. So we set about trying to do something about that.
And what these poachers would do is they would go into these villages, the villages around the park. The people were very, very poor. They were only thing they had to do to make a living was subsistence agriculture, which just planting a few crops of corn. They were really quite desperate. So these commercial poachers would go in, and they'd hire the people to be carriers, and the people would have to walk 60 miles into this national park and either shoot or carry the meat. And the poachers would only pay them a handful of meat for an expedition that would take a week or 2 weeks. It was very hard, dangerous, and illegal work, and they just paid them a pittance. So we went into the villages, and we had meetings with the people, starting with the chiefs, and we said, you know, if you stop hiring out to these poachers, we will help you get other jobs, we will start little industries, we will set up a loan program, and that's what we did. And we set up an educational program in the schools, and we set up a rural health care program so that they could have clinics, because when we went in there, the people would have to walk 3 days just to find a nurse. So basically, we improved their livelihoods, and they didn't have to poach anymore. And it took longer than we thought. It was frustrating that it took so long, but eventually we completely stopped it. And as Mark said, the poachers were shooting 1,000 elephants a year in that national park when we first got there, and about 8 years later they shot none.
It's a very complicated sort of problem to attack because, as you say, here you have local people who are involved in this and who are getting a little something out of it. And for them, if you could do something to improve their lives, they probably would be fine with that. There would be other people, the people who were involved in the poaching, and then going up until to no doubt people who were elites in the country, highly placed individuals, people who were in the government, some other people that were making a lot of money on this, and no doubt they would be real unhappy. They were real unhappy that you were getting in the way of their making money.
Well, they were increasingly unhappy. The fewer elephants that died, the more unhappy they became, and they were unhappy. There were elements of the civil service of the government of Zambia at the time, from the game scouts in the field to the police in the villages to the magistrates to the army, which used helicopters and trucks to poach, to the administrators in national parks and the ministries. I mean, they were a lot of people were involved. Not everybody, but a lot of elements of the civil service were involved. So, of course, and they were making a lot of money, and of course they became very unhappy. And then there were the poachers, the organizers who came into these villages to try to hire shooters. They were unhappy, and many of those were people who were armed with AK-47s, and they began shooting at my airplane regularly. Eventually they sent assassinations into our camp to kill us and several times, and at one point I even got a report, or received a report from an informant that we had working undercover in some of the villages, that they were trying to, some of the major poaching figures were trying to secure a shoulder-fired missile from corrupt elements of the military to shoot down my fixed wing and my helicopter. So it became very, very serious and very stressful for us. The more successful the project became and the more support we generated amongst the village people, in many ways, the more dangerous it became for us.
So eventually that was that the reason that you decided to leave Africa?
Well, yes, but it went on for years, and what happened before it got too terrible is that what kept us going, of course, I mean, we were living every day like this. We had to have armed guards in our camp. We had to have bunkers, sandbag bunkers in our camp. I mean, it was very, very stressful. But what happened is the more we helped the villages and the villagers, they became on our side. So we had these thousands of people who were depending on us and who were so happy that we were there. And they started running the poachers off, and they started telling the politicians they wanted us there. So we did have this support from the villages, but the more support we got, then, of course, that also made some of the higher-level people mad, and they tried all kinds of ways to get rid of us. And in the end, it did become just too dangerous and too stressful. And in fact, what they did was we came on a home leave once to raise money. We had to come home once every year to raise money to the States, and they orchestrated some of these corrupt officials orchestrated an illegal takeover of our camp. They and our project headquarters in the village. They just took, you know, trucks in with people, paramilitary armed with AK-47s, and surrounded our compound and put our staff under house arrest, including a Peace Corps volunteer. And so it was terrible. But fortunately, five embassies came together and helped us rescue our people. And so we were able to secure our project back again. But it was just the American ambassador, who was a very good friend of ours and a very good friend of the project. He knew the project very well. He said, look, the time has come. It's just too dangerous for you to return. But the good news is that the project continues. It continues to this day. It's now 20 years old, and it's now, we finance it as much as we can from this country, but it's run by Zambians, and we can go back. There's nothing that says we can't go back, but it's the project being run beautifully by Zambians, and that is the most important thing of all.
Well, we're about at our midpoint here, a little bit past, and so let me, for anybody who might have just tuned in, introduce again our two guests, Delia and Mark Owens. They have been involved in doing research and conservation work on endangered species in Africa for now more than 20 years. They met back in the early 70s when they were graduate students at University of Georgia, and after they got married, had this great dream to go to Africa to do this kind of work there, and they, I think they were afraid that if they didn't go, it wouldn't be there by the time they got around to it. So they did. They went to Botswana and spent 7 years living there doing studying lions and hyenas, and wrote a book about that, Cry of the Kalahari is that book, and it's still out and available. A little bit later in time, this was in the, say, the mid-80s to the mid-90s, they worked in Zambia, where initially they went to do the same kind of study, to continue to study lions, but they realized there was a very serious problem there going on with poaching, particularly killing elephants for ivory, elephants and rhinos, but also killing other animals as well. And so they developed this North Luangwa Conservation Project to try to give people who lived around this park some alternatives to killing the animals, helping them develop small business and do things to improve their lives. And it was very successful. And also in the process, they had the opportunity to spend a lot of time studying and observing elephants and their behavior. And they have written two other books. One is The Eye of the Elephant, and most recent is Secrets of the Savannah, and that's published by Houghton Mifflin. So if you're interested in reading it, you can do that. They are scientists. They're well thought of in their field. They published in journals including Nature, Journal of Mammalogy, Animal Behavior, Natural History, and the African Journal of Ecology, and also articles have been written about them for a number of popular publications. And now they're living in the United States and continue to do conservation work in the northwestern part of the U.S. And are particularly interested in grizzly bears. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Now, I'm thinking back to the story about, you were talking earlier about Botswana and the fact that fences were put up to try to keep the wild animals separate from the domestic animals because somebody thought there was a possibility of hoof and mouth disease passing from wild animals to domestic cattle. And that's why they put up the fences. And the problem there is that it goofed up the normal migration patterns of the wild animals, and it was very bad for the animals. And I guess I'm thinking about the fact that probably in a lot of places there people would make this argument, that is, government officials would make this argument that said, well, preserving the environment, wild places, animals, that's all well and good. But what we have to think about is economic development of our country to the betterment of the lives of our people, and that you can't do both.
Well, that's fair enough. That would seem to be a cogent argument. The only problem is that the commercial cattle industry of Botswana, the benefits from that go to a handful of people, and mostly at the top. And furthermore, these fences are often built right through villages and separate villagers from the wildlife on the other side, and sometimes from their own stock. Furthermore, these ranches that are often developed, these commercial ranching blocks, as they're called, often tap into fossilized water, fossilized aquifers, and in a few years, the fences they've strung up have killed off the migratory wildlife that the Bushmen, frankly, need to, and Bakalahari need for protein, and still subsist use. Yet they use these animals to subsist on, and the fossilized aquifers go dry, and the cattle ranches are bust, and they move on, and they leave behind a pile of skeletons and tangled wire and true desert. So it's not a sustainable enterprise, and it is being fostered by soft loans from the World Bank and heavy subsidies by the EU at the expense of wildlife, which is sustainable. And so it is a tangled mess, frankly. And it's too often what happens in the name of development across the continent. And it's something that not just the continent, around the world, and it's something the Earth is not going to stand for too much longer.
When you think about it, the wildlife that lives in the desert is adapted to that condition, like the wildebeest. The Kalahari could support a lot of wildebeest. They could be used for local meat, but they also can be used for tourism, which can bring a lot of money into countries. In fact, a lot of countries, Kenya, Botswana itself, and Tanzania, make a lot of money from tourism. But the cattle are not adapted. So as Mark said, they go in, try to put cattle in this area. It only works for a few years, and then the area is overgrazed, and they move on. But then the area has been ruined for the wildlife. So if you look at the continent of Africa as a whole, and you find the areas where they have conserved their natural resources, where they have not overgrazed, where they have not had industries that don't fit the environment, there are no starving people. If you look at the areas that have put cattle in, who've overgrazed, who've stripped, in places where they have stripped the natural resources, that's where you find famine. And so you need to go back and look at the fact, you need to consider that natural resources are not a luxury, they are the basic need, what we all need. And that's what's too often overlooked in a place that's marginal like Africa.
I don't fault the government of Botswana so much for what's going on with fences and the decimation of wildlife, so much as I fault the the EU and the World Bank, but especially the EU, shortly after we were there in the 70s, they heard our reports and saw them because we made sure they did, and they sent a mission out to see what was going on, and they saw with their own eyes from the air migrations that were blocked by these fences, hundreds of miles, hundreds and hundreds of miles of fences across the open range, and they saw thousands of animals dying, and they went back to Brussels and they debated it, whether their subsidies and the waiver of tariffs and so forth to the meat market were wise, but they did nothing. And so in the meantime, the next 30 years, every time there was a drought, the same sort of mortality happens over and over again. And since the late 40s, one could estimate easily that not just hundreds of thousands, but millions of migrating animals have been killed by these fences. And they have yet to be proven to actually do anything to control hoof and mouth disease. Every time there's been an outbreak in Botswana, the virus has spread across fences. How do you keep a virus contained that can spread on the feet of rodents across fences, birds across fences? Virtually, you'd have to literally sterilize the earth on either side of the fence of all wildlife. And in Botswana, they've tried to do that on occasion with tractors and wagons and riflemen roaming up and down the fence line, shooting any animal, wild animal that comes near the fence. So it's just, and again, it does not control hoof and mouth disease, and hasn't, and it's
a disease that's never been found in the Kalahari anyway.
We've talked to the original architects of some of those fences who've quite candidly admitted that they were slapped, in their own words, they were strung across the landscape, ill-conceived, and could be redesigned or even taken down now. And yet they persist because the EU's convinced everybody that they're needed.
Well, I have a caller here who'd like to talk with you. Let's
sure.
do that in a nearby community, Muhammad, and this is on our line 4. They're calling on a cell phone. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Fascinating program. Actually, the commentary, your guest took a little bit of the wind out of my sail for what I was going to ask, but that's fine. I'd just be interested in your assessment of the guest with sometimes well-intentioned endeavors, although maybe sometimes not so well-intentioned, like the EU and the World Bank with the fencing, and then it has this more devastating effect, creating more problems. My question is really your assessment of the continent at large, if nothing is done proactively, as you two demonstrated, 10 years, 20 years out, where do you see Africa, the population, the AIDS epidemic, the loss of animals? Your assessment, I agree with. How much more can the Earth take? I don't know. I wish we could get the world's community to see the situation. The problem with the fencing is so haphazard and it causes so much devastation. I'm just curious as to your assessment 10, 20 years out. Is it too late to do anything? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for your comment, your call. It's not just Africa. Africa, with its marginal soils and its tough climate, is the tip of the iceberg. It's feeling the symptoms first of a global problem that we've got to address, and that is the piecemeal collapse of life support ecosystems around the globe. And again, Africa is we see it in Africa most alarmingly because Africa's soils, nitrogen poor lateritic soils, for example, and their long dry seasons and periodic droughts. They don't have the deep hot soils of the American Midwest and the genial climate that we do, and with relatively fewer pests and so forth that buffer them along with the high technology against the incipient vagaries of the environment. And what we're seeing globally is a collapse of ecosystems or a beginning of ecosystems collapse. And in 10 to 20 years, if it continues in Africa, what you see going on there now, the worst, is only going to get worse. And so organizations like the World Bank and the EU have got to stop putting Band-Aids on problems and importing exotic schemes into Africa that literally exacerbate the problem rather than making it better. And I'm talking about growing exotic crops and that require heavy machinery, for example, and that sort of thing. And they are, to some extent, getting the message, but subsidies of industries or rather technology like these fences are still ludicrous, and they need to just admit that after all these years and the expenditure of millions and millions and millions of dollars and the deaths of millions of animals, they've got to admit they were wrong and take
but
a different tack, like vaccination, for example.
But the thing is, we also are very hopeful, too, because if you look at the large picture, it doesn't look very good, but we see a lot of hope, too, because we showed that it could be done. And this project that we did in North Lwangwa, I mean, 20 years ago, you had all these elephants being shot. You had people very poor and desperate, and it was really a very dismal situation. And look at it today. We're working now in 52 villages. The people have jobs. They have little industries that are not hurting the environment. We didn't do things like introduce goats because goats can overgraze, but we have, you know, fish farms and beekeeping and things that do not impact the environment adversely. But the people have jobs now, they have health care, they have education, and the national park is revived. The elephants are starting to recover, and the other wildlife is recovering. And it's all by going in and taking one man and one woman at a time and giving them another opportunity. And it worked. And I think that model is now being used in other places, and I think it's a big part of the answer.
It's the application of appropriate technology for the area. And as Delia said, starting grassroots initiatives that work village to village. And what's so wonderful about what's going on there in North Lwangwa now is that, A, you have a park that's being revitalized. It's, in fact, the most secure national park in, I would say, almost in Africa. It's so secure that black rhinos are being reintroduced. And black rhinoceros are, as you know, highly sought after by commercial poachers because their horns are worth thousands of dollars on the black market. So to reintroduce black rhinos is an indication of how secure that is. Animals are being seen in areas far afield from the national park where they hadn't been reported in 10, 20, even 30 or 40 years, as distant as 100 miles from that, from the original project area. People have doubled the food security that they used to have and are making as much as 100 times what they made by collaborating with commercial poachers. So it is reason for hope, and this model, in fact, is being replicated in other areas of Zambia.
And we haven't even talked about the elephants much, but I'd like to just say a word about that. We did have the opportunity to study these elephants, and what a wonderful joy that was. When we first came into North Lwangwa, they would run when they saw us a mile away because they were so frightened by people because they had been so heavily poached. But then they started seeking sanctuary in our camp because they soon learned they were safe there. And we put radio collars on them and studied them. Also, we had this little orphan elephant named Gift. She's a big character in our book. She started hanging out at our camp. She was only 5 years old when she first came in. But after studying the elephants, we found that since many of the adults had been shot,
93% of the adults had been shot,
the adolescent females were breeding. Individuals who would have been considered sexually immature before our study were giving birth. For example, females before poaching gave birth to their first calf when they were 16 years old, and Gift gave birth to her first calf when she was 8 and a half. And we found that most of the births were by females who were very young. So you had these teenagers. There was a population of teenagers. And it was fascinating because the young males started forming gangs, and there were single moms and teenage mothers. And we looked at this and we thought, what does this remind us of? And it very much reminded us of some of the stressful human populations, in, you know, of our species. So they they were under stress and we were under stress, and they were exhibiting some of the same characteristics that we do. But it took quite a few years, but now their elephant numbers are beginning to recover again, and these young female mothers who weren't great mothers at first because they hadn't had an opportunity to learn from older females, now they're starting to form the same groups, and they're becoming matriarchs as they were in the past. So it's all coming back to normal now.
Yeah, it is, as you say, a really interesting part of the story, particularly about how it is that the loss of the adult animals, how it is that disrupted elephant society, in a sense, that they're very social, the animals, that is, they live in social groups. And without the adults there, it disrupted what would have been the natural patterns of behavior.
Well, people, again, have to be reminded that these elephants live to be 60 or 65 years old in the wild in unstressed situations. And during that time, males and females learn a great deal about their environment, which they pass on and teach to their young. And that collective wisdom was shot away. But I'll just give you some of the examples of learned behavior. A young female has to learn from her elders in the matriarchy to move her leg forward so that an infant elephant, her first calf, can access the teat to suckle. And if she doesn't do that, the calf may very well die of dehydration and starvation. Another interesting behavior that I saw often from the air, you'll see elephants go crossing the swift rivers, for example, and calves, infants hanging onto the tails in a long line. Well, when the elephants were shot away in North Along, where there weren't enough tails to hang on to, so mom would take her trunk and position her infant on the upstream side of her shoulder, and the current of the river would hold the infant against her shoulder as she and her side safely away from crocs and while she moved across the river. And so these behaviors are in a long-lived animal like elephants are often passed on, and there's an instinctual basis for many of them, but there's also a large learning component.
Hmm. And our new book, Secrets of the Savannah, is a happy story. In this book, the poaching is over. It takes over. The book starts after the poaching is over. I just wanted to mention that because I know some people don't want to read about it, but it's a wonderful story about how the elephants are recovering, and how the people around the park were recovering. It all sort of once everything got on the right track, everything started coming back together again, and we had many elephants who started living in our camp, and we knew them by name, and we could stand 5 or 6 yards away from these wild elephants. Now, of course, there were some problems. We mock charged quite a few times, and cheers, one of the bull elephants would come in and eat the thatch off of our roof, and he'd turn around and rub his backside on our little thatch roofs, and the little huts would shake with him rubbing his backside on it. So we had some wonderful encounters with these elephants, and it was so special that even though we were the same species as the poachers, they learned quickly that we were safe, and they accepted us completely.
Hmm. Well, I want to try. My apologies. We had a caller that I was going to try to get in there, and I think I made him wait too long, so I'm really sorry. We're just about at the point where we have to finish. It might be interesting for folks to hear you talk a little bit about what you're doing now, because I know that you in recent years have been involved in kind of the same effort. And that is trying to preserve grizzly bears in northern Idaho. And apparently there aren't that many groups of grizzly bears or places where they are in the United States now, at least not in the lower 48 states. Is this something that where there's concern about these animals continuing to survive?
Oh, absolutely, David. We're working with remnant populations, really, of grizzly bears in the Selkirk Mountains along the western side of the Kootenai River Valley in extreme northern Idaho in the Panhandle, just below Canada. And also we've done some work with a few bears in the Cabinet Yak Wilderness area across the valley from the Selkirks. And there are only about, when we arrived here in 96, 1986, we discovered a project, a fish and game project, that was pretty much moribund. They had almost no funding and one collar on one bear, and we set about helping them raise money to collar as many as 11 bears and revitalize the entire project, which has sought to secure some of the bottom land, the spring and summer range, the river floodplain areas that are much more productive habitat for the bears than the mountaintops, to which they had been relegated and kept there in the past. Here we were trying to recover a population of maybe 25 or 30 bears, but there was no access to their most productive part of their habitat, which was the river floodplain. So we've not only supported the research on the bears, but also involved ourselves heavily in a program to try to acquire floodplain habitat through easement programs and outright purchases so that the bears have access to the spring and summer range from the mountaintops where they had been more or less relegated in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm at the point here, and I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. If people would like to read more about the experiences of our guests, Mark and Delia Owens, their experiences in Africa, they've authored the three books, Cry of the Kalahari, Eye of the Elephant, and the most recent is Secrets of the Savannah, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. Also, if you'd like to learn more about them or about their activities, they do have a website. This is the website for the Owens Foundation for Wildlife Conservation, and their website address is www.owens, so owens-foundation.org, and there you will find more information about them and their time in Africa and also the subject that we're just here talking about. And, of course, you can go out to the bookstore and look for Secrets of the Savannah. And at that, Mark and Delia, I want to say to you both, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, David. Have a good day.